The World Health Organization defines addiction as a chronic relapsing condition. Dahab Private Hospital recognizes that addiction is a multifaceted illness affecting an individual's physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, social, and practical well-being. With 28 and 90-day residential rehabilitation programs and Dahab's accredited private health fund approved treatment service, you or your loved one can get the help you need to navigate the rehabilitation process to regain control, to overcome that addiction, and to take back your life. If this resonates, then take the first step and call Dahab Private Hospital for addiction treatment. Addiction is treatable and recovery is possible. 1-800-329-422 or dahab.com.au. Dahab is one word, D-A-Y-H-A-B, dahab.com.au.
G'day team, welcome to another instalment of The You Project. Hi Melissa over there.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, thank you. How's your weekend travelling?
It's been really good, thank you. How about you?
Look, not too bad, but I did reveal to you before, we won't unpack it. Maybe we'll unpack it with Jackie. I don't like myself today. I realised something about myself and I'm going to, maybe Jackie can give me some free coaching and counselling later, but that's not why we're here. Jackie Lauder is who we're here for and why we're here. Hi, Jack.
Hi, how are you going?
Look, we're going good. We're just rolling along. You probably haven't noticed, but we're 416 episodes deep in the You Project.
I've definitely noticed. I stay on board.
Well, I'm very grateful and very thankful for your support. And for those who don't know, Jack is, she won't tell you, but I'll tell you, she's in the top few in Australia in as a sports psych. She's a gun. She's a media personality. She's a presenter. She is a longtime friend of mine, and she is was a longtime radio co-host of mine on Melbourne's Home of Sport, SEN All Sport Day, All Sport All Day, and we had the science of sport, and before that, just regular bullshit on SEN. But we had our own show for about 5 or 6 years that had a little bit of a cult following on Sunday mornings, didn't it?
Yeah, do you know what? I think we ended up getting 7 years out of that show. We still get hits on Facebook on the page.
That's hilarious. Well, that show has a longer lifespan than this show, so you never know. It's funny since we started, like I started in radio 100 years ago and you and I did probably our first radio thing together. I don't know what you did before that, but you and me probably did radio together starting maybe 12 years ago. Yeah. Oh no, more. But it's interesting how the world has changed in terms of we've gone from media to social media to podcasts to YouTube to blogs to vlogs to, you know, the plethora of platforms that we have now to create our own little, for want of a better term, radio station or our own channel where we can, you know, broadcast our own kind of messages to the world. It's so different now, isn't it?
I know. It makes you feel ancient when you think about the way we used to do it. Same as when I used to go to uni. You had to go to uni.
Yeah. Well,
now you just get to sit there and watch it on a screen.
Well, that is so true. Like I was only about 4 months into my PhD when the world fell apart and they went, you can't come in. You got to do your PhD at home. And I went, I don't even know how to do it when I'm here. I need actual academics around me. I go, you know, I've been sitting in that fucking cubicle pretending, right? What do you mean I've got to do it from home?
Man, that's tough. I loved going to classes because I like having other people around me to discuss things and learn. So I reckon I would have struggled if it was all online.
Well, I certainly, I wouldn't say I struggle, but it's, well, one, academia is not my natural habitat, as you both well know.
Yeah.
And two, you know, having like, I have two supervisors. So when you do a PhD, you have, I know you know this, Jack, I'm just telling our audience that don't know, you have generally two or three or four academic supervisors who all have different kind of strengths who kind of coach, support you. But it's the thing is, when you're doing a PhD, you're busy anyway, but the people who supervise you are busier. So trying to access those people is trying to book a, like trying to book in with a Pope.
Yeah.
Book in with fucking Beyonce or something. It's not that easy. So
which they don't tell you when you sign up for it. You think because you're at the uni and they're at the uni, well, this will be easy. And it's actually not.
Yeah, I'll just slide by his office and just rock in with my 9 questions. Oh, no, you won't. But how's next Thursday at 4:17?
Yeah.
Like, what? But, you know, look, I mean, mine, you know, Murat, who's my senior, he's great supervisor and he's the head of neuroscience for Monash, like globally or something. He's a genius. But Lucy, who's my second supervisor, is great too. But, and they're very, very, because they're perpetually doing, and of course, it's not just me they supervise, but they've got their own mountains of research and grants to write. And what do you call it? Where you're applying for grants, applications. And
yeah,
you know, there's a whole world that I didn't, I'm like, oh shit, there's a whole world of shit that goes on that I had no idea about any of it.
Yeah. And then you get, and the ethics, I think, is the hardest part because you go back and forth and you sit there going, this is so simple. Imagine if I was doing something complicated.
Oh, and well, there's all the shit you don't think of. Like, people go, what do you mean you get ethics approval? Oh, what, do you just tell them what you're doing? And they go, yes or no. I go, nah, not really. You fill out this online thing, which is about 45 pages.
Yeah.
And, I mean, my research is, you know, if there's a scale of risk, it's very low risk.
Yeah.
Because it's literally just 400 humans filling out questionnaires. It's not like we're slicing up dolphins or something in a lab. You know, I mean, it's – sorry, Melissa. Sorry, everyone. We're not doing that.
Of all the examples.
Well, I don't know. It's not like we're doing anything that's highly
– you're not invasive
unethical or, you know, we're not putting probes in people's brains.
Yeah.
But it's that's what it is at that level. You know, it needs to be so super-duper-duper tightly controlled and rigid and perfect and the – you know, the process, the protocol needs to be flawless so that when you finally write that first, second, third, whatever paper, because I'm doing academic articles, I'm not doing an 80,000 word thesis. So then it's got to be submitted. Well, it's really being submitted on behalf of, you know, like the funny thing is you do the work and you write the paper and you do the research, but you're like the third banana on the paper.
Like, your supervisors go first. You're like,
yeah, that's right. It's like there's the big banana who's Murat, then the middle banana, Lucy, and then there's fucking the tiny banana at the end who's the engine room of the whole fucking thing.
Yeah.
But
welcome to academics.
I definitely couldn't do it without them anyway, so I'm happy to be the third banana. But, yeah, you're right. So you send in, you go, so this is how we're doing it, and you send it in for ethics approval and then – you think, oh, Brian will look at it tomorrow, I'll get it back lunchtime. And no, that doesn't, it takes weeks and weeks. And then you get it back and they go, nah. You're like, what do you mean, nah? They're like, nah, change this stuff. You're like, oh, really?
It's a really good test for your ego, isn't it?
Oh, I put up my hand and go, I'm the worst fucking PhD student ever to grace the doors of Monash. I'm like,
I reckon you're not.
Yeah, well, anyway, we're doing it and we're having fun and, you know, it's been a steep learning curve, but you know, there are, I mean, when I spoke to you earlier today and said, can you have a chat? I said, let's not plan. We'll see where we go. But as I'm talking, something comes to mind and you, wherever you want to go, I'm happy to also, but have you ever given thought to or looked into or investigated or perhaps even studied at some level learning styles as in, because obviously people learn optimally in different ways, you know, we talk about whatever auditory and kinesthetic and visual and, you know, some people love reading books. Some people, you know, it's like a lot of my friends are reading books at the moment, but they're actually listening to them, which is cool. Oh, I just read such and such. I'm like, I didn't know you read. Well, actually I listened. Doesn't matter. You're still consuming the words, but do you have any thoughts or better understanding than me, which is not much, so it wouldn't be hard, of how to discover our learning style or how to optimize our time invested in learning or studying? I probably should have asked you this before I started my PhD. Fucking hell. Could you give me some kind of gem?
So learning styles for me is actually a thing I find out about every athlete I start working with, and particularly if you're doing it in a group, and then when you're working with coaches, it's really vital because most people will teach the way that they learn. And it's amazing how many people will say, you know, oh, they watch a lot of movies. Oh, I'm a visual learner. I'm like, well, hang on. If you can recite everything you've learnt from a movie, you're also auditory because you're repeating everything. So a lot of people will use the VARC, which is, you know, your visual, auditory, reading, writing, kinesthetic. And that's probably the most popular and the most simple way to find out someone's learning style. And it's used a lot in sport. But it's then managing, I guess, over to the practical side and being able to take that into account. But I think the other side for me, apart from the learning styles, is I've then gone and read, I don't know how much work you've read of Ken Robinson. So
we love Ken Robinson.
Yeah. So I think reading a lot of his stuff for me, because just because you've taught it doesn't mean someone's learnt it. And that's, I think, been a really big thing for me when working with so many coaches is just because you've said it, don't assume that every person in the room has actually walked out and learnt it. I think it's a huge area that we definitely give a heap of time to in sport.
And I think this is, you said a bunch of good stuff there, but something that you said is just because you've taught it doesn't mean that they've learnt it. And also, I think on some level, unconsciously, most people who are standing talking to a group, they, as long as they speak clearly, then they think that everyone is automatically understanding them.
Correct.
Whereas, no, dude, it's not how articulate you are or how clearly you define your words. It's about whether or not you're speaking a language that connects with them or whether or not they actually even know what the fuck you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think when you go in, and I'm really mindful when I do any presentations or even working one-on-one with clients, is that I use a whole variety of mediums. I'll write things down for them to take away. So that's sort of your reading, writing. I'll use pictures or videos or explanations. I draw things out. You'll obviously have conversations. So, you know, if you're using all styles in what you do, then you've made it possible for everybody in the room to be able to take something that really dials in with them away. But I'll constantly make sure that I check in. There's no point saying something if it's not going to be of use to anybody.
Yeah. When I'm doing, we do ongoing mentoring groups. You'd hate it, Jack, because it's online. So I'm looking at tiny heads on screens on Monday nights. Yeah. But that's just the world we live in now. And I'm very grateful that we have the resources that we have. But we have on Monday nights 230 people. Well, we have 230 enrolled. They all listen at different times because it's recorded. But trying to connect with a whole bunch of people in, different places, different time zones, different countries, different personalities, and realizing that, you know, you are, my intention is not necessarily their experience.
Yep.
You know, and being able to think to yourself, how do I explain this idea or this concept in a way which will resonate with the most people? Like, how do I do that? And also understanding that, you know, everybody's going to plug in and listen for 2 hours because it's 8 till 10. And so I hammer home this, I know you don't want to, I know some of you go, that's not the way I learn. But as much as you can, please try to write stuff down. Like, not all the time and not incessantly, but what I know is if you listen to me for 2 hours and you write nothing or take not one note, the chances of you remembering 10% of what I said in those 2 hours are zero. Mm. And then the chances of you applying that and creating some kind of benefit from that stuff. So let's listen, let's write, let's take notes, let's highlight. And I think you're right. The more kind of modalities that you use, be that video, be that PowerPoint, be that writing on a whiteboard, be that interactive activities, then the more likely people are to at least remember and then potentially apply.
Yeah, I think too, like, I don't know what you do. When I read books, I always have, you know, those little colored tabs.
Yep.
And so I can maintain and get that flow when I'm reading a book. If there's something that really resonates with me or makes sense, I go back, put a colored tab in it. And then once I finish the book, I go back and I actually type out notes from each book on those coloured tabs, so that I've then got a really great summary of all the books that I've read and what I've got out of it. And often that's just a file that I'll take with me on a plane and just reread.
Yeah.
So that I don't have to reread the whole book, but there's no way I'm going to remember everything that's really good coming out of a book. But if I tab it, I'll learn more.
I was talking with not a great friend, but a guy that I know reasonably well recently, and he's, I don't know what he is, 45. And he said, we're talking about this kind of stuff. And he said, you know what's interesting? He said, I reckon until 2 years ago, I'd read maybe one book in my life, like something he had to read for school and probably didn't even read it properly. Mm. And he goes, I always had this story in my head. I'm not a reader, you know? Yeah. And then he went away and he read like three books in the holidays. I don't know what prompted that. And he said, in the last 2 years, I've read over 100 books and I fucking love reading books, right? And he's like, all of a sudden, like he'd been telling himself this story and this was, I'm not a reader. I don't learn well that way. This is not how I'm wired, blah. But he just never really committed to giving it a go.
Yeah.
Because he had a story in his head that it's kind of boring, and maybe when you're 14 it is boring. But now he's this like voracious reader and he sends me messages, mate, you've got to read this. It's fucking life-changing. I'm like, settle down.
I'm looking forward to retirement because I have so many books that people have recommended that I get, but I just don't have time to read absolutely everything.
Yeah.
And I think it's you know, people often think that's what you do. And I spend a lot of time with my head in a book or listening to podcasts if you're traveling. But sometimes too, I think there's room to just not learn. And sometimes you just got to take a break because you can get so overloaded and exhausted from so much information that I think that can be confusing sometimes as well. And that's why I'll often just go through and do summaries from books and make a few notes while I'll always have a pad and pen with me if I'm listening to a podcast so that I can either follow things up. Whether it's a website or a concept or whoever you've had on. I talked to you the other week, this morning, sorry, about a couple of them that I've really enjoyed that you've done. And I think, you know, for me, the learning isn't the thing I'm doing right in the moment.
Yeah.
It's what I take away from the thing I'm doing.
Well, we chatted briefly this morning and you were talking about the, what's her name, Barbara Arrowsmith. Arrowsmith-White or something, the lady, the neuroplasticity lady who basically, you know, healed herself and created her own program.
Amazing.
I learn, or I don't know, do I learn? Yeah, I tend to learn better and retain better and get more inspired when I'm just hearing somebody talk about their journey and the lessons and the insights and the wisdom is in the story.
Yeah. Stories are amazing. That's why I did sign.
Literally when you're telling someone a story, as long as it's a good story, they're plugged in mentally and emotionally and you're literally affecting their physiology. So, but when you're just going, here's my third graph on my seventh slide, people like checking their Facebook feed.
Yeah.
You know, so it's trying to find that formula that works for, and I reckon that's what, you know, I think that is the challenge for teachers. It is so hard for a teacher with 30 kids in a room, like one teacher, 30 humans. Good luck. Teachers cop a bit. I mean, I love teachers, but I think some teachers unfairly cop a bit. And I just think it is so hard to be a teacher. I respect teachers. Obviously nurses, people like that, but to teach 30 young, imagine trying to teach me and my mates when we were eight, fucking hell. And then times that by 30 kids, I was a little prick. I was out of control.
I remember when I was in grade six, our classroom, we had 36 students in my class.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. They would never do that these days, but that's a lot of kids in a class. So yeah.
I wanted to ask you a couple of psychologist things. Before we do that, it's very reticent of me. I did pump up your tires at the start, but it's all true. But it is all true. Tell us, before I ask you my psych questions that I actually personally want answers to, that I hope someone else is interested in the question, tell us as much as you can, a snapshot of who you are working with at the moment.
Yeah, so I'm still at Olympic Park Sports Medicine Center. So that's my clinical practice where I do one-on-ones. And then actually taken on a little bit more this year. I didn't think I could get busier, but I am. So I'm working at Melbourne Storm still. So this will be my fifth season now, with them.
I know 90% of our listeners know who that is, but we've got about 15% of our audience is overseas now. And probably a fair percentage are not necessarily sporting people as well. So tell us who Melbourne Storm are.
So Melbourne Storm are in the National Rugby League. So they're a team here in the Rugby League. So, so I've been with them for 5 years, and now I'm also working with Collingwood Footy Club. I've been with them for 3 years with their AFLW and their SSN netball in the National League. And this year I've taken on the AFL men's team down there as well. So I'm pretty much across their teams at all their teams at the club now. So it's a big year for me.
So you're working with Melbourne Storm, Collingwood men's team, Collingwood's football ladies team.
And their netball team.
Great. Yeah. Good. Okay, yeah. So you'd be and you're working at Olympic Park seeing people one-on-one.
Yeah. So it's busy.
There ain't many people who make me feel lazy, but well done.
Yeah, and then I'm taking an online subject, a postgraduate sports psych subject that I lead for Melbourne Uni. So it's postgrad, so it's all doctors and physios, which I really love taking that.
Mm. So you – oh, right, so you're obviously teaching them. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I was thinking, why are you doing – right.
No.
When you're working – I mean, let's just talk. Okay. Are there observable differences between, I mean, apart from the fact, the obvious physiological differences, but the way that you would coach someone who's an elite athlete, and this is very broad stuff here, but general member of public, you know, Brian, the accountant, who's just struggling with a few issues, he comes to see you, or Brianna, she comes to see you, and a couple of issues and overthinks a bit of anxiety, a bit of stress, procrastinates a bit, fucks around, wants to get better, da-da-da, versus a national-level professional elite athlete. Are there common themes or are there common differences? There are things that you can identify?
I think, obviously, if you're doing performance-based stuff, then yes, but humans are humans. So I think once you've got a pretty good understanding of how the brain works, it's basically taking everyone's individual story and working with the information they've given you and learning their personalities and trying to give them strategies that they can implement in their life. And because everyone's got a different story, like, you're not going to have two people the same. But I think when you've got the understanding of like I said, that neuroscience and how the brain works, I think I don't find it too hard to adapt. I think the biggest thing is making sure you listen to their individual content and not just assume, oh yeah, I've seen 20 people with anxiety, this will be the same. You can't afford to do that because it's experienced differently because everyone's got a different story.
How do you navigate a situation where someone comes to you because the club really wants them to, but they're not really that excited to be there? You know, they're there because they kind of have to. I'm not saying they've got a terrible attitude, but they'd rather not be there. How do you negotiate that on day one?
You know what? Like, this is going to sound a bit bizarre to people, but that is very rare these days. Like, that doesn't really happen so much. If it does, like, I'm quite happy to actually acknowledge it and say, look, I understand that, you know, this is where you sit. This is also what the club needs us to do. So let's get done what we need to get done. Use me as much or as little, but these are things I think I can give you, and we'll just work it from there. And so I think, you know, not pretending that you're the oracle and you've got every answer in the book, but also acknowledging their discomfort or just their lack of buy-in sometimes. But that's actually very, very rare these days, I think, because now – certainly, you know, sport performance exercise psychology is so much more embedded into professional sport. I think athletes and coaches and everyone around are realizing this is, you know, this is such an untapped area they spend years and years working on the physical, but anyone who can make an AFL list or an elite sporting, you know, career, they're very talented. So why are they not able to then just take that next step? So you don't get a lot of resistance these days, which is refreshing.
What about when you've got to have, or do you ever have to have, is probably a better question, tricky conversations with coaching staff where, and of course not with Collingwood Football Club or Melbourne Storm, but, you know, historically other clubs, because we know that Collingwood and Storm have got it nailed.
Yeah, of course.
But you know, do you know when you go, like, even in, and I'm not nearly as invested, or I wasn't, as you are currently, like when I work with St Kilda and the Vixens and Port Melbourne for a while and all that, where you're kind of like, I've got this role to do here, and it's a really specific role, is to get their bodies best prepared for this sport. Like, you've got to get, hopefully, their minds best prepared for their, you know, the role. But you guys are kind of fucking it up because you keep changing the rules on me and you want me to do this, but you're kind of getting in my way. And because one of the things that people don't think about in a sporting club is that there are 1,000 moving parts, and everybody wants access to the athletes, you know, all the different coaches at all different levels, and psychs and dietitians and fucking running specialists and biomechanists and doctors and physios and, you know, there's like 1,000 moving parts, and you are one of the cogs in the Collingwood machine, and everybody cares about their own role. They don't give a fuck about your role. Do you ever have to have difficult chats?
Yeah, for sure, because I think the difference with us and the role we play is that you might have your strength and conditioning person. Well, not everyone is talking to the athlete about strength and conditioning, so they're able to separate, but everyone's talking to the athlete. So to be able to come into to any club, you have to be able to try and get a really common language established and help coaches and staff and whoever understand the way you communicate, the language you want to use, so that it's consistent for the athletes. But also, you definitely sit there at times and, you know, you'll cringe or you'll think, oh, that's not the way to say that. But I think that's where, if you establish your role and the relationships with your coaches and your footy managers or your team managers or whatever, I think everyone is generally pretty open to listen. And my conversations are normally, I 100% got your point and I think your intention was right. Could we just reframe this a little bit? Could we use this language instead? Because I think that's going to get a better connection for the athlete, or these are words that work better for them. So you're basically rewriting a lot of communication when you go in and work with a new individual or a new team.
I remember you and I sitting in radio studio at 473 Swan Street, Richmond. I would say
We spent hours sitting there.
Fucking probably over 1,000 hours. But
easy.
I remember you and I on air a little bit, but more off air, probably circa 2007, and you expressing to me your frustration, we won't say with whom, but just in general with, and I think you were speaking globally for psychologists, where you kind of went, and I completely agreed with you because it had been my observation too, that that people almost back then, and we're talking over a decade ago, but back then it was all almost like, oh, well, we better have a psychologist because you kind of got to have one. You got to be seen to give a fuck about their mental health, even though we didn't speak about mental health openly back then to any great extent. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like you felt pretty often undervalued, underappreciated, and probably somewhat not really respected. And it wasn't about your ego. It's just that you're this person with all of this knowledge and skills that can really fucking help this team. But there were people there that didn't understand how valuable you could be. And so you didn't get a lot of space.
Yeah, I think that's 100% right. You know, things have changed so much in the last decade, where I think most teams and most individual athletes are realizing, and most humans are realizing, that you need to be able to talk to somebody, and that, you know, I think coaching particularly is people management, and we study it for years. And if they've been an athlete and then they go into coaching, that like they're misunderstanding exactly how much of their role is really managing the personalities of the athletes that they coach, whether that's in athletics or in football or in tennis. I can find 1,000 people that can set up a footy field or teach tennis skills, but not going to find 1,000 people that can understand my personality and know how to communicate and bring out the best in me. And I think, you know, when people just do disrespect all of the years of training and understanding that we've had, it's come such a long way now. And I think this generation of athletes that are coming through are so much better educated. They're more emotionally intelligent. They've grown up more in a world where it's okay to not be okay. So I think they lead the charge, and they're demanding that people like myself and other psychologists are in their environments now, because they don't want to tell the coach everything, or, you know, they need strategies when they're out on the footy field or in the swimming pool or whatever. So I think the athletes are very much driving a lot of this. And now the coaches are also understanding that they have to have someone, because we help them as well. And I think with the world of social media, like, you know, particularly if you're a high profile athlete in your sport, you know, you look in the wrong direction and someone's writing about it. So, you know, I think just to help with all those pressures, our role has definitely changed in the last decade for sure.
I think inside of sport, that's good. I'm glad to hear that, because it wasn't awesome, but it seems from the outside looking in that you have a lot more leverage.
Yeah.
A lot more responsibility and a lot more recognition and acceptance, which is awesome. Within the context of sport and outside of sport, we often hear something like, I just don't understand him. I don't understand her. Like, I do not get what is going on, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And to me, that's like, cool. Okay, good. Well, good acknowledgement. How might you understand them then? Like,
yeah.
So that's a good acknowledgement, but really what they're doing is just expressing their frustration rather than opening a door on something more positive. When people say that to me about their partner, quite often it's their partner or their kid or their business partner or a colleague or a workmate or something. I go, well, that's good that you acknowledge that. You know, what next? How might you? And so I've banged on about, and everyone's sick of it, you know, where I talk about the subjective nature of being human. We all look through our own window and all that shit, right? How do we better understand others? Now, when I say that, I don't mean how do we better agree with them or align with them or even fucking like them, but how do we better understand others inside sport, inside business, inside relationships, inside parenting, so that we can create better connection and better outcomes?
That's a massive question. So thanks for the heads up.
No pressure. So the question is, no just pressure. While I give you a bit of think music, I mean, in other words.
I get the question.
Yeah. How do we like.
So I think for me, one of the starting points is try and listen without judgment or assumption. And actually listen. Most human beings, by nature, what they'll do is they'll listen to the first 3 or 4 words and then they either want to fix it or they want to jump in when someone else is talking. So I think listening is a hugely underrated and underdeveloped skill for pretty much most people. And I think, you know, being able to then reflect back to that person and get them to clarify. So what you're saying is, this is how you're experiencing this. This is how this feels. Don't forget to actually check in with them on that.
Mm.
So, and listen to someone's story, because I think too much as human beings, we judge people on the result or the action, and we don't actually pay attention to the intent. And I think if you try and figure out, okay, where is this person coming from? Why are they doing that? What did they mean? We get angry because their tone may not have been right. Well, don't worry about their tone. Find out why their tone is the way they are. So I don't feel like we ask the why question enough. Yeah. I think we talk about what happened and where it happened, but I don't think we ask, hey, why did you do that? Or why are you feeling like that? We judge it from an emotional perspective and say, well, you shouldn't think that and you shouldn't feel like that. Well, oh, well, thanks, Freud. Like, oh, you know. You're a genius.
Thanks, Sigmund. Like, I'll take it on board.
Exactly.
I think.
Whereas we just make a judgment and we just go, oh, yeah, I understand that I can fix it. No, if that's what that action and that sentence may have meant if you said it, but that's not what they mean when they say it.
That's the fucking slipperiness of words, isn't it? Like yeah. You think about a word. What's a word? It's just a bunch of letters in a particular order that we just spew out into the atmosphere. And then all the different brains that circulate around that word tell themselves, it's like, how often do I say fuck on this show? And 98% of the time, no one gets bothered. Maybe 1% of the time people go, oh, Colin, I wish you'd cut back a little. And another 1% people are like, that's it, I'm not listening. But you think, isn't it interesting? Because it's the exact same stimulus. Yep. It's not like I'm saying a bunch of different things. I'm saying the same thing, but it's, you know, and it, I guess it's that, you know, I had a revelation, brothers and sisters. I had a revelation from the most holy. No, I had a revelation when I was about, I don't know, Jack, maybe 40, so 2 years ago. And I remember I had a moment with my old man. I can't even remember what about, but we butted heads a little bit and, you know, it wasn't major. Like him and I have had about 3 arguments in our life where I actually stood up to him. There would have been a lot more, but I was too scared the rest of the time, still too scared. He's 81. He's fucking terrifying. But I remember Mum said something to me like, and she didn't say exactly this, but what she was kind of saying was, if you understood his story, you would understand him, right?
Yep.
And I went, oh, she's like fucking Yoda. I'm like, hang on. I'm like, oh, because I grew up, compared to my dad's upbringing, I grew up in relative privilege and opulence, albeit in Latrobe Valley riding my dragster and hanging out with, you know, my mates riding up in Edward Hunter, which was a forest reserve, right? But my dad was raised in, I won't give you all the details, but let's just say his childhood was shit compared to mine. You know, one of 8 people, one of 6 boys in a single income household living in the Depression. Let's just say that money and love and food weren't abundant. And then, you know, lots of other things that happened to him and starting work, like full-time work at 14 and, you know, just all of these things. And you go, oh. And then when I kind of understood my dad more and stopped expecting Ron to be like I wanted him to be, I thought, actually, considering where he's been and what he's seen and what he's done and considering his journey compared to my very comfortable journey, he's actually pretty fucking good.
Yeah, and I think too, a lot of people in various situations, they focus on their own experience and, oh, this is, you know, this has upset me or this has made me mad or I really enjoy this, instead of going, hang on, why, what's driving or what, where's that coming from with what that person said? We just think about ourselves. Human beings by nature, super selfish. We always think about our own experience and then we'll either make someone fit into it or we'll have a crack at them because they've made us feel uncomfortable. Well, I'm not sure too many people intentionally try to do that. So if you try and look a lot more at intent rather than delivery and action, I think we understand people better. But I think so much of it is actually listening and letting someone finish their story and ask questions before you summarize it or think you've nailed it.
Do you reckon that we tend to gravitate towards people or listen more to people who sound essentially like us?
Yep.
It's like the old, you know, confirmation bias, the echo chamber, you know.
Or I think sometimes too we listen to too many people. Like, you know, and I certainly feel for athletes these days because every man and his dog's got an opinion on them, their performance, every component about them, and yet probably 1% of people actually know them and have taken the time to get to know them. So I think it's hard when you've got so many people that can comment on your life and your world, but really know nothing about it.
Do you think that athletes are under more pressure now than they were 20 years ago? Because
absolutely.
Okay. Yep. Tell us why.
Because 20 years ago, they could go home, have somewhat private lives where, you know, it was basically the written newspapers. That was life and that's where things. But now there's more sports journalists than there are athletes. If you look at our biggest sports for us, like the AFL and the NRL, But now every member of the public has forums where they can express it on everything. So now the ego is being hit from so many different directions. Again, not very educated ones, but you had somewhere to hide and you had some level of privacy before. They don't have that now. The game has changed. The game's faster. I can't watch sport anymore with commentators because it's just a lot of dribble and they don't really understand the athletes and they've been out of sport for 10, 20, 30 years. They've got absolutely no idea what these athletes go through now, the travel that athletes have to, you know, experience to be able to go and compete everywhere else in the world. We're much more fluid. I mean, obviously pre-COVID, much more fluid now. Athletes are on planes all the time. They're away from their families. I mean, God, who would want to marry a cricketer or a baseballer over in the US? Like, you know, you really want to talk about sports widows. That's what you're talking about.
Isn't it interesting? It's funny how you say that the commentary, I'd never really thought about it, but as I just sit listening to you, so many times where sports commentators, and I'm not trying to throw them under the bus because I've probably done the same thing, but we'll talk about their the personality or the mindset or the psychology of an athlete. I'm like, how do you know?
It's correct. You know, like, they don't.
Like they're literally giving a commentary, public commentary on what's wrong mentally with that athlete and what they need to work on. It's that's pressure in itself.
Yeah, I think for me that's one of the most frustrating parts is that they think they know and they actually don't. And particularly if it's an athlete that I'm working with, it really frustrates me when they comment on that sort of stuff because we mop up a lot of the shit and the mess that they create. And when they start attacking people and their families and their partners and all of that sort of stuff, or they'll say someone's, you know, oh, they're not very resilient. I'm like, where's your evidence? Like, you know, that's like me saying, well, you're intellectually not very smart. And I could probably provide a lot of evidence because of that stupid fucking comment you just made. But like,
Hey, just in case you're a journalist and you're tuning in, don't criticize Jackie's athletes or she's coming for you.
You know what, though? I think that is part of, you know, and I know probably this is, I guess, for us as psychologists, you have to be very, very self-aware and you do have to show a lot of control. And whilst I probably didn't show it in that comment just then, I'm very protective, as I know a lot of my colleagues are, of the athletes that we work with because we know so much about them and their personal lives and what makes them tick. And we spend so many hours talking to them that you are going to be, you know, fiercely defensive of them and protective of them because I also know the damage that gets done. And I just like to see, I think, certainly through media outlets and everything else, just a little bit more empathy, compassion and thought before they make some of the personal comments that they make. Like I've never met an athlete that deliberately goes out there to screw up. I've never met a footy team that goes out there to lose by 80 points. Like some of their comments, they should stick to what they know rather than commenting on what they don't know.
Well, instead of talking about what, you know, the sport per se, they're talking on the mental or emotional state or the resilience or, you know, essentially, I mean, probably not a lot lately, but I've heard a lot over the years where, you know, footballers are basically called soft.
Yep.
I'm like, could you imagine somebody saying that to you, how that would affect you? And I think also, and this seems ridiculous, but, you know, I think also because some athletes, and not most, by the way, because you and I have both worked with, you've worked with more, but lots of Olympians who get paid fuck all.
Nothing.
But I think, you know, like a lot of professional athletes, sometimes people are not very forgiving because they go, well, that's just part of being whatever, you know, he's on $1 million a year or she's on whatever, you know, fucking suck it up. That's the, well, no, they're not getting paid to be insulted or publicly humiliated, or they're getting paid to be good at sport. And just because they get paid a lot, that doesn't mean they deserve, you know, to be bloody emotionally shafted publicly because you have an opinion that's based on fuck all.
Yeah. And well, I can imagine going the opposite.
I was just going to say you, because you know them behind closed doors and you know the person, not the athlete.
Yep. And they're definitely not, you know, they're not an athlete when you're talking to them. They're a human being.
Hi guys, Melissa here. So you might have noticed that we ended this episode a little more abruptly than normal. That's partially because we experienced a bit of an internet glitch at this point in the recording, but it's also due to the fact that when we jumped back on the call, Craig and Jackie got on a bit of a roll, and we thought rather than cutting the conversation short, what we would do is just keep recording and turn this into a two-part episode. So this right here is the end of part one. We will be back tomorrow with part two. But until then, thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed it, and bye for now.
The addict in your family might need you to take the first step for them. They Have Private Hospital for Addiction Treatment has the experience, staff, resources, and processes to help you help your loved one. DAHAB's model of intensive rehabilitation has revolutionized the practice of addiction treatment in Australia. Registered with the DHHS, Department of Health and Human Services, DAHAB now offers rehabilitation programs for drug, alcohol and gambling addiction and is a private health fund approved treatment service. So if you or someone you care about is fighting addiction, there is hope. Addiction is treatable. Recovery is possible. Just ask me, call. And there is light at the end of the tunnel. DAHAB Private Hospital for Addiction Treatment. Call DAHAB on 1-800-329-422 or learn more at DAHAB, DAYHAB, or one word, .com.au.